This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 27th of March 2012 here on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, broadcasting live from Studio One at Monocle 24 in London. I'm Nancy Durham. Coming up, we'll check in on Burma's election campaign with the vote just 5 days away. We'll hear from the former managing director of Monocle magazine and get her take on the city of Darwin.
What I did is I took a day out and I found a car and driver and I said, OK, I'm a tourist. I've just landed in Darwin. I want to know, Darwin, where are you going to take me?
All the tea in China, well, some of it anyway, will be tea tasting in the studio. And we'll also eavesdrop on some bookshops. A bookseller shares her experience with silly questions she and others have been asked. Of course, we'll play some great music too and tell you the news right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. And with that latest news, we have Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. The main Syrian opposition bloc has voiced support today for a peace and ceasefire plan drawn up by the United Nations and Arab League special envoy Kofi Annan, so long as it leads to the removal of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Annan said the Syrian government has accepted the plan. Basma Kodmani, a spokeswoman for the Syrian National Council, said she would like to see the Syrian regime end attacks on its opponents before believing it.
We look for any opportunity to see the killings stop from the regime's side, and that if the plan is indeed accepted, we of course are very cautious when we see that the regime is accepting anything. We would like to see that implemented on the ground immediately, and compliance by the regime is still something we need to see happen.
Meanwhile, Syrian opposition members said President Bashar al-Assad's troops pursuing rebels had actually crossed the border into Lebanon. Syrian National Council member Adib Shishashki accused Lebanon's army of complete inaction.
This regime has absolutely no respect to borders or to any neighboring countries. And it's expected he is following the protesters all over, to the border of Turkey, to the border of Lebanon, even today, cross the border into Lebanon. And sorry to hear that the Lebanese army is letting them to do so.
Iraq has asked countries at an Arab League summit to forgive its pre-invasion debts, urging others to follow the United Arab Emirates and Algeria, which have already agreed to write off what they were owed by their fellow OPEC member. An influential Russian lawmaker, Alexei Pushkov, has today accused the US Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney of pursuing a line of confrontation with Russia. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev also criticized Romney, saying his comments smacked of Hollywood. Romney branded Russia the number one geopolitical foe when speaking to CNN in response to a conversation in Seoul on missile defense between Medvedev and the US President Barack Obama. Obama urged Moscow to give him space until after the US election, and Medvedev said he would relay the message to Vladimir Putin. Pope Benedict has prayed before the statue of the Virgin of Charity of El Cobre today as he wrapped up his visit to the East Cuban city of Santiago de Cuba. After spending time in the sanctuary, the Pope departed for the capital, Havana. On Wednesday, he will hold an open-air mass in José Martí's Revolutionary Square. A massive haul of the gourmet abalone that was illegally harvested in South Africa was returned to the country today after it was seized in Hong Kong. Rampant poaching has decimated the population in South Africa's coastal waters to feed demand for the high-priced delicacy in Asia, where the mollusks have also been over-harvested, forcing buyers to look elsewhere. The proceeds from selling the abalone will go to a fund aimed at protecting South Africa's marine resources, says Lionel Adeldorf, a spokesman for the country's fisheries department.
When it arrived at the Hong Kong harbour, we managed, without a relationship with the Hong Kong authorities, to have it confiscated there. And then after a lengthy period of discussions and negotiations, we had it returned to South Africa. And today, South Africa had exposition of 3 tons of illegally poached, harvested and processed abalone, and with a street value of 7.5 million rand.
And finally, more than 100 people have gathered to vie for the title of Japan's fastest hands, competing to stack a set of plastic cups into a pyramid in the shortest time possible. The 2012 Sport Stacking Competition allows competitors to show off their skills in a so-called sport that organisers say teaches eye-to-hand coordination, improves reaction time, and uses as much energy as archery, bowling, or volleyball. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
And I thank you, Jonathan Wheatley. Is that a sort of, is that something for the Olympics, do you suppose?
I think that could be a great sport.
What were they stacking again?
They're stacking a set of plastic cups into a pyramid in the shortest time possible.
Do we know how high it got or anything like that?
Not yet. All I know is they're in the process of doing it.
Demonstration sport for the Olympics,
absolutely,
perhaps this summer.
Absolutely. I think it'd be a great idea.
So nice to see you again.
Thank you very much. Nice to see you. You're looking great.
Thank you. From the hills of Wales, nothing like a bit of fresh
homeland. My homeland.
Yes, I know. Okay, thank you again. And I've got a couple of newspapers here, a couple of front pages from New Zealand and Australia. First, The Press, New Zealand newspaper. And the front page is really taken up with photographs of the rebuilding of Christchurch. It is amazing how much of that city, of course, it was flattened by the earthquake, but further flattened as the cleanup goes on and the buildings with weak structures have to come down. One of the signs, one of the cut lines under a photo is "No vacancies, all that remains of the Hotel Grand Chancellor" in central Christchurch yesterday. So this is an 18 months more of reconstruction and deconstruction in the so-called red zone, those cordoned off areas in the center of Christchurch. We forget just how devastating it was and how long it's taking to put that grand city back together again. Front page of the Sydney Morning Herald, a couple of different stories. Apparently the US military has its eye on the Cocos Islands and Keeling Islands, which belong to Australia, as future Indian Ocean spy base possibilities. So watch that space. And customs staff are in trouble in Australia. More than two dozen customs and border protection officials are being investigated right now for corruption or misconduct, and the suspected offences include things like drug trafficking and leaking sensitive information. That from the Sydney Morning Herald. And now to take us all around the world to tell us about the weather is Tomasz Szafranaker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And first up, Europe. The warm and sunny weather continues. Most of the continent is enjoying conditions more typical of May, even early June in Western Europe, the UK, for example. In southern Sweden, highs are approaching 18 degrees too. But there are some areas of the continent where it's cool and fairly disappointing. So on to Wednesday's city outlook. And one of these places is Istanbul, 10 degrees with showers. London, 22 and sunny. This is 10 degrees warmer than normal. Rome at 23 with sunshine, and in Barcelona, also sunshine, 22 on the thermometer. Across the Atlantic to North America now, and good weather across the eastern seaboard for the moment, sunny skies. But by midweek, there'll be some rain in New York City, Boston, so that northeastern corner of the US. Also, it's cooled off in southeastern Canada after that spell of unusually warm weather last week. Back to early morning frosts in Montreal. The Pacific coast, from Washington State to northern and central California, cloud and rain. It's cooled off as well. Here's Wednesday's city outlook. In Montreal, 5 degrees with rain. Chicago, 19, partly cloudy. New York City, 15 with a few showers. And in San Francisco, 14 degrees with rain on and off. In fact, rain for most of the week. Let's take a look at some other world locations and airports the next few days. You might be travelling via Dubai, perhaps a stopover here. 36 degrees with sunshine. At Johannesburg International, 24 degrees. Could be some bumpy showers on arrival. In Hong Kong at Chek Lap Kok, mostly sunny. Highs of 27. That's all from me. I'm meteorologist Tomasz Szafranaker here on Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, of course. And it is now 9 minutes past the hour.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Oh,
Oh, I love those voices. And this is Midori House on Monocle 24, and I'm Nancy Durham. Well, it's just 5 days to go until Burma's parliamentary by-elections are underway. There aren't enough seats up for grabs to threaten the military-backed government. But symbolically, of course, the elections are hugely important because Aung San Suu Kyi will almost certainly occupy one of those seats. We've reached Monocle contributor Preti Nalu in Thailand. Hello, Preti.
Hi, Nancy. It's interesting you should mention the military because today is, in fact, a national holiday in Burma to commemorate the 67th anniversary of the Burmese Armed Forces. And marking the occasion, the Commander-in-Chief explicitly defended the military's role in the political landscape of the country. And I have to say this is quite contrary to Thein Sein's administration, Thein Sein being the president, their claims of being the new civilian administration. So it's quite clear so far that the military is going to wield quite a bit of political leverage.
And perhaps on some level, not surprising, it's still in the country's constitution, as it were, I think, that the military is entitled to some 25% of the seats in parliament. Is that right?
Correct. The 2000 constitution has been cited time and again by critics as a huge obstacle in terms of substantive political reform in the country. I have to point out that as elections are approaching, the state publication New Light of Myanmar has announced that elections will be cancelled for the time being in Kachin State, an ethnic minority area of Burma, and they've cited security reasons. And there is indeed a huge security crisis, but it is civilian life that is bearing brunt of this conflict that has been ongoing for almost a year now, since the end of a 17-year ceasefire between the Kachin Independence Army and the state military. And we're now talking about 75,000 civilians who've been displaced due to this conflict.
Okay, there's so much to take on board here, but this rebel territory I've been reading about and the Kachin, the confrontations, are the rebels fighting? Are you saying it's a one-sided thing that's going on there? And why does the fighting continue there when there is this opening of society elsewhere in Burma?
Well, what has become obvious over the course of this political reform discussion is that most ethnic minorities, and there are over 100 ethnic minorities in Burma, so the notion of a singular Burmese state is actually quite misleading because a lot of these ethnic minorities have been fighting for autonomy since 1949. And for these constituencies, the concept of reform is still a distant notion. A lot of positive initiatives have taken birth in the urban centres, but it'll be a while before these remote regions can feel the effect. And a lot of this is going to be dependent on ceasefire talks that have been ongoing and how steadfast and equitable the administration is in terms of implementation. But going back to what is happening in Kachin State, finally a UN convoy was able to reach about 2,500 families who've been displaced there, but the scale is unfortunately much, much larger. And from speaking to colleagues who've just returned from Kachin State, it does not look like the fighting will stop anytime soon. And the situation for refugees who are now in makeshift camps has exacerbated with no resolution in sight. At a modest estimate of about $1 per person per day, it will cost about $75,000 per day just to feed these IDPs.
Preti, just to jump in here, I don't like to push this terrible mess to one side, but can we please, for a moment, just to look at the campaigning that does continue in other parts of the country? How is that campaign going? Is a fair democratic campaign underway?
Well, there has been significant progress, and that can't be denied. For example, election monitors have been invited to observe the elections, which is quite unprecedented. And the opposition parties, NLD and NDF, have been relatively positive in terms of their response. It's really difficult to say how much of a difference these by-elections, let's bear in mind these are by-elections, will have in terms of long-term impact for the country. Aung San Suu Kyi has been quite positive as well, but it looks like she's been quite pragmatic about the whole situation. So There has been positive progress in terms of campaigning as well. She's been able to campaign in a way that was probably not possible in 1989, which was the last time when she won with a majority of over 80%. And she is being received by large crowds, which is a very positive sign. And her posters are all over the country. But it remains to be seen what will happen after elections.
Is she well now? She was out of the mix for a few days with some terrible stomach bug or something.
I don't think it's a significant cause for concern. There hasn't been very much reportage on that end. It looks like she's fine and she's continued on with her campaign, and she's definitely been in the news quite a bit. And she has been criticizing the administration in terms of corruption and other issues that need attention at this point of time.
And as you say, you know, we can't make too much of it. It's a by-election. It's small. But her, if she, for instance, and other reformers get seats, I mean, that will be the moment to watch. What are they allowed to say? What kind of campaign can they continue to conduct once they are in office?
Well, as you said, it is a by-election, which means it's 40 out of over 400 seats in the parliament. So obviously the outcome will have proportional consequence. And having spoken to some people inside the country who are politically active, she might be given a ministerial position, but her powers within that position might be limited. But it's still quite a bit of progress, considering the fact that she was persona non grata in the media and has just spent about a year since her detention, which was ongoing for 14 years.
Amazing. And, you know, reading, you know, the news outside Burma, the outside world is just, you know, clamoring to get in for business, for travel, for to help, to do whatever. Inside Burma, is there a sense, when you're there or in contact with people there, a sense of great excitement or hope that these walls are really going to break down, that sanctions will be lifted, that a new world is imminent?
You know, as you said, sanctions are the big sort of discussion at the moment, and this is why the by-elections are significant, not because of their immediate impact on the political climate in the country, but because they are the big litmus test in terms of whether or not the US and the greater international community will lift sanctions. But as far as people inside the country are concerned, it's not just ethnic minorities, it's even majority Burmans who are living in rural areas. Reforms are really yet to reach them, so people just get on with their daily lives, and they react positively to when their basic needs, such as electricity, healthcare, and educational services, are improved. And we're yet to see significant reform on that end.
Thank you very much for sharing all of this with us tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy.
Bye-bye. That was Monocle contributor Preeti Nalu on the line from Thailand. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barenna jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
The Globalist bids good night to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia, with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run-through of the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
There's a lot of money in this country. It's a very strong economy and it's really growing rapidly, and so it's the natural choice.
Wake up in Europe to The Globalist, live every weekday at 6 a.m. London time, here on Monocle 24.
Now, most shop assistants confronted with a difficult customer grit their teeth, smile sweetly, and just get on with it, you might think. But one North London bookseller was so taken by the strange questions she was asked that she started writing them all down. She also took note of the crazy questions customers were lobbing at booksellers across the land. Other booksellers, that is. Weird Things Customers Say in Bookshops is Jen Campbell's new book. And the book is here, and Jen is with us now live in the studio. Hi.
Hi.
I mean, I think we just have to start by the cover of your book has a very goofy person asking, do you have any books by Jane Eyre?
Yeah.
Which says it all, sort of.
It does. It does in the cover. I really like the cover. It's illustrated by Greg McLeod. It's very nice. I think that does say it all.
But I have a real problem with this because my image of people who go into the lovely bookstores of the world are
intelligent people. They
want to be engaged. Okay, so what's going on?
Well, this collection is over a 3-year period, so it's not like these things happen all of the time. It's just when they do, they happen to be remembered because they're particularly outrageous. I think you can rest assured that most people who go into bookshops say very intelligent things.
Was there a moment when something was lobbed at you and you thought, okay, oh my God, I've had it. I'm going to now really start recording them all? And what was that moment?
There were two, actually. One of them was when I was working at the Edinburgh Bookshop when I was doing my English degree, and someone had asked my boss if Anne Frank had ever written a sequel to her diary because she didn't realise that it, wasn't fiction. That was particularly, there's nothing you can say to that. So that was when I started writing them down myself. But then one day when I was at the bookshop, someone came in and asked if a Mr. Patrick lived in the shop. And I said, no, if he works here. And I was like, no, he doesn't work here. Sorry, I think you've got the wrong place. He's like, well, does he live here? And I was like, no one lives here. It's a bookshop. And he looked around and went, are you sure? So I think that day I started writing them on my website. So that was when they started as blog posts, those
right.
ones. Yeah.
So maybe bookshops are safe havens for all kinds of lost souls. Maybe all kinds of people just sort of turn up there and they kind of know they're safe places.
Maybe. I think that bookshops definitely are a safe place, and the regular customers and everyone, you really feel like you get to know people and the books they read, and especially the kids as they grow up, you feel like almost like you're helping them grow up. I don't know if that sounds really arrogant, but the books that they choose and you see as they go, and that's really nice.
Now, let's broaden it out a little bit, because when we think of bookshop these days, we think of that the dreadful internet taking all the sales away, but there's so many movements to keep the local bookshop going.
There are.
Do you think bookshops are rising to the challenge?
I hope so. I think definitely there has been a backlash. I think in America recently when Amazon did a promotion where if you went and price checked something in a bookshop that wasn't a book, you got a £5 voucher. $5 voucher for Amazon, and I think that in particular made people, because they are rivals, that it used to be like big chain bookshops, now it's Amazon, and I think it used to be, well, separate rivals, but that kind of thing brings it together, like you're actually fighting properly with the bookshops. I think people are fighting back. I hope it's not too late. I really hope it's not too late, because I think the bookshop have a lot to offer to people and booksellers. And Amazon, I think, benefit hugely from bookshops themselves. I know people go in and use them as, almost Amazon storefronts, and then will go home and buy them on your computer, which obviously annoys booksellers a lot. But I think that's something, I don't know if Amazon acknowledge that I think they need us too.
Is there a talk underway to do some sort of deal with Amazon? Could be mutually benefit. You go to John Lewis to look for a washing machine and buy it online there or
someplace
else. I know,
but it's just terrible. Like in the book, which happened in Edinburgh, someone called us, and it happens a lot. And I've talked to booksellers. It happens. People call or come in and they ask for advice. Like they don't know what to buy. Normally their child or a grandchild, they're not sure. So they get all the advice and then they think it's okay to go order it somewhere else. It breaks our hearts, really. It's our job. We're doing it. And then we don't get the sale. It's sad. It is.
Mm. Are you're still in a bookshop?
I work in an antiquarian bookshop at the moment in
Ripping
North
Yarns.
Ripping Yarns.
A really great name.
Yeah, well, it's owned by Celia Mitchell, and it was opened... it was a bookshop. It's been a bookshop since the 30s. It was reopened in the 80s by her and her husband, and Michael Palin and Terry Jones opened it for her, which is why it's called Ripping Yarns.
Do you have any good recent Ripping Yarns from there? Any silly questions or thoughtful questions?
Silly questions? Well, a thoughtful one.
I'd prefer a thoughtful one, actually.
Well, there was this really sweet thing from a child, actually, last weekend. He just walked in and he looked around in absolute awe at all the bookshelves, and he turned to his dad and he went, "Dad, bookshops are really special places, aren't they?" And I was like,
"Yeah.
You're going to be a bookseller when you grow up, if there are any bookshops left." lots of things, I guess. And a silly thing that was recently was someone who picked up an old copy of Oliver Twist and asked if why there wasn't a barcode, because he wanted to price check it on his iPhone. But, you know, it's from the 19th century.
New generations don't know there was life before barcodes, I guess, right?
Right. But we had someone come in yesterday who bought lots of books and came to the shop. He was like, "I really want to say something weird, but I can't think of anything to say." So we have had people coming in because of the blog. I fully expect people coming in to deliberately say weird things to me in the future. That's fine.
Do you have a favourite from all of this collection?
Oh, no, that's a really difficult question. I do like the person who ran in looking panicked and asked if we had a book on star signs. I said yes, and she said, "Well, I really need to read it because I have this overwhelming fear that something terrible is going to happen." So that one was quite fun. There was a lady who cried because we didn't have the last Twilight book in stock. We'd sold out. And she'd taken the whole day off work to read it. And she demanded that we ordered it so that it would get there this afternoon, which obviously we couldn't do, but we said it would be here by the morning. So she said, "Well, okay, well, do you have..." Oh, sorry, "We have lots of other books." And she said, "Well, do any of those have Robert Pattinson in them?" So, yeah.
So all kinds.
All kinds, all
and
kinds.
And antiquarian bookshops. This is a kind of random question. What are people looking for these days in old, old books?
Things from their childhood, absolutely. People looking for nostalgia.
And favourites? I know that depends on the generation. But
it depends. Well, the stuff that we sell is lots of Angela Brazils, lots of Jess William, Jennings, Biggles, old Arthur Rackham stuff as well. Old editions of favourites like Alice, things like that.
Childhood favourites.
Yeah.
People want to go back, or I guess pass them on to the next generation.
Absolutely, yes.
Jen Campbell, author of Weird Things Customers Say in Bookshops, thanks very much for joining
much.
Us. You are listening to Midori House. And now we have some music, and this is Once in a Lifetime by Talking Heads. Once in a Lifetime by Talking Heads. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
LDNTYO. NYC MT4.
Thank you, Carly. And in the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be sipping tea with a connoisseur. But first, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much, Nancy. The main Syrian opposition bloc has voiced support today for a peace and ceasefire plan drawn up by the United Nations and Arab League Special Envoy Kofi Annan, so long as it leads to the removal of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Meanwhile, Syrian opposition members said President Bashar al-Assad's troops pursuing rebels had actually crossed the border into Lebanon. Iraq has asked countries at an Arab League summit to forgive its pre-invasion debts, urging others to follow the United Arab Emirates and Algeria, which have already agreed to write off what they were owed by their fellow OPEC member. An influential Russian lawmaker, Alexei Pushkov, has today accused the US Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney of pursuing a line of confrontation with Russia. Romney branded Russia the number one geopolitical foe when speaking to CNN. Pope Benedict has prayed before the statue of the Virgin of Charity of El Cubre today as he wrapped up his visit to the East Cuban city of Santiago de Cuba. After spending time in the sanctuary, the Pope departed for the capital, Havana. And a massive haul of the gourmet abalone that was illegally harvested in South Africa was returned to the country today after it was seized in Hong Kong. The proceeds from selling the abalone will go to a fund aimed at protecting South Africa's marine resources. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan Wheatley, with the news headlines. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One with me, Nancy Durham. During Monocle's launch, Robin Holt worked as the magazine's managing director. Now, 5 years on, she's been back to visit us to talk about how the magazine has grown and to discuss her new role at the Australian Northern Territory Tourist Board. Robin talked earlier with Monocle's Steve Bloomfield about the country's booming north in Darwin and beyond.
Robin, welcome to Midori House. Welcome home, sort of, isn't it?
It sort of feels a little bit like home, and I've got to say, although I only know now about four or five people from the original, we were all scrambling to get the first issue out, and now I look at floor after floor of the most amazing people, and these studios.
Who on earth are these people?
No, it's not even that. I mean, I actually really look at the diversity of the people that you've employed, and I believe there's only sort of 50% of British people here, and the rest are very diverse, which is obviously makes the right mix for you.
It does. I think we have about 23 or 24 languages spoken on the first floor,
which is incredible. And
I just speak one of them.
What is that, Birmingham?
Yes. Yes, that's quite true. Yeah, myself, Andrew, and Tyler are perhaps sort of, Tyler's good with his languages, but certainly me and Andrew with, I think, one each.
Can I tell you about the vision that Tyler first had? Because I was here at the very beginning when we raised the money to actually put the magazine together. And I remember Tyler saying, my vision and my goal is to have a really international desk where people can watch the news in their own language from their own television stations and tell you what the subtext of the news is rather than the pre-digested amount you get from CNN or any other international cable. And I think you've obviously achieved that.
No, it certainly seems to sort of work like that when you have a morning meeting and there's, you know, someone from Finland who says, well, look, this is a big story in Finland. And then you've got someone from Brazil who says, well, look, this is what's on the front of Folha de São Paulo. And then with our bureaus and correspondents as well, it certainly gives an international flavour to how things are. But you're back in England at the moment in a different role, aren't you?
I'm here really as a visit and to perhaps, if you like, fill my eyes with the other side of the world. I mean, coming from Australia, it is a 24-hour plane journey to get anywhere. So it's one of those things that I come to this side of the world and actually drink in what's around. Tyler very sweetly asked me to come back and actually look at Monocle after 5 years, having put a strategy together for the first 5 years to actually see where it is, if you like, on that spectrum. Let me say it's way ahead of anything that Tyler... He did say... There was something about broadcast, but I think what's very interesting is to take a printed version of a magazine and to start Monocle 24, which sort of dovetails in but isn't. It's, you know, really independent. And it's against the swim of everybody who is so web-focused as a market. Then suddenly you've got this whole broadcast side that I really believe in. I think it's fantastic.
Well, the main thing we wanted to talk to you about was, in fact, based on a story that was in the fifth anniversary issue, the March issue of, of Monocle, all about Darwin, which is a city which you now know very well as the chair of the Northern Territory's Tourism Board. Let's talk about when you took up that role, which was last November?
Last November. Right.
What did you know about Darwin and what did you think you were going to have to do in this role?
I started my relationship, if you like, with the Northern Territories, and it really is a relationship. Many years ago, being on the Voyagers Hotel Board, which is in the centre of Australia, but still part of the Northern Territories, and is now owned by GPT at that time, part of Lendlease. and has subsequently been bought by the indigenous people of that area, which is a very, very interesting, it's not an experiment, but it's a very interesting program put together of getting the, you know, traditional owners to actually manage and run their own sector of the tourism business. So it's not without its hiccups, but it's going quite well. So my relationship goes back probably 10 years. I was on the board of the Northern Territories Tourism, and then I was offered the chairmanship. And last November, I thought, yes, I come in here, I come to board meetings, I listen to the ministers, I listen to all the other things, but do I really know Darwin? So what I did is I took a day out and I found a car and driver, and I said to this really loquacious and lovely man, okay, I'm a tourist, I've just landed in Darwin, I want to know Darwin, where are you going to take me? And I thought, I want to see what they are going to see and how it really influences me. So from, first of all, Darwin is a city that's really, you know, since, I mean, Cyclone Tracy in 74, which completely wiped it out and flattened it, it's been rebuilt in some very clever ways. There's some great architects there that have slightly held on to the sort of old tropical feeling, but married it to quite a modern city. So it's built around the water's edge, as most things in Australia are, embracing that water's edge. So from a convention centre, which is a beautiful new convention centre, a huge U that runs around the water's edge, one with, because they don't have surf, because you wouldn't want to be going in that water with crocodiles.
No, no.
they have a wave, which people actually ride. And then all along the other peninsula, there are beautiful restaurants that have set up where you sit outside. Darwin, of course, is a climate that you either love or leave, as someone once said. So lots of outdoor, indoor sort of areas. So there's a bit of history. There's also what they've done is they've sort of moved it up into embracing what it is about the East and where they sit within the East. So a lot of markets that embrace Asian food types. It's fabulous going to the markets. I mean, they're really, really exciting. Great restaurants with not an infusion of Asian, but a complete marriage of different Asian tastes.
So do you get the sense it's a city that, you know, faces north to Asia, perhaps more than it faces, you know, south, east to Sydney, Melbourne?
Completely and utterly, Steve, I've got to tell you, their eyes are constantly cast north because the relationship down to Sydney, they're closer to Asia than they are to Sydney. And if you look, our whole tourism, you know, focus right now is on China. It is a market that is really opening up. And so consequently, the first stop, if you like, you know, on the bus, the first stop on the bus is going to be Darwin. So there is a focus on, do we need all of the things actually written in Mandarin that are either at our tourist bureau? And the tourist bureau, I have to say, is the most fabulous thing. It's an old Reserve Bank building. So it stands in a parkland all by itself. And you go in and you're immediately immersed, not just in Darwin, but they have a map of Australia and all of the indigenous languages spoken and where they are.
Oh, okay.
And there's an enormous amount of languages. Sadly, a number of them have been lost. But it immediately takes you into, you know, where you are in a foreign country. So I've got to say that Darwin, right now, I'm in hail to Darwin. I'm becoming their greatest, you know, their greatest fan, is actually offering Asia a lot. Not just go out and put your backpack on and go and do all those things, but a level of sophistication, a level of food, which we know that Asian people and Chinese people in particular like to eat their own food. They like to actually stay within the comfort of a group. They like to read their own language. They like to have people do their own interpreting. And all of this has actually been embraced by the tourism group.
And there's also, I guess, a geopolitical element to, you know, Darwin's closeness to Asia, and that's that when the US wants a base to make sure that it has a presence within the Pacific region, that Darwin is the obvious place. And President Obama was there just last year or the
last
start,
year.
Yeah, just at the end of last year, and said that 2,500 troops, US troops, would now be based there.
Eventually. Yeah. I mean, right now I think it's quite small and it will build up.
Yeah.
And we're very aware of that from a tourism perspective, because what that does is it brings families who are going to come into there, children who will need education. So just the assimilation of that. The other very big coup was on the oil and gas discovery. As you know, INPEX and Total did a $34 billion, it was the biggest deal that's ever been done in Australia. The people, the local people from Darwin, were a bit worried about how this is going to be handled, particularly in their harbour, as I said. But it's been handled with a lot of sensitivity about where they're going to build it, how their platforms look. But again, we're talking about a massive influx of people who are working there, employment for the local people in Darwin, so, and as well as a lot of money flowing through there.
Is there a bit of wariness from some Darwin residents that a lot of things are going to change quite quickly, both with the new US troops coming in and then, you know, whatever happens with the oil and gas?
Mm-hmm. I think that there is always going to be, when there is change, a certain amount of hesitancy about what it is. The thing you've got to remember about Darwin and about the Northern Territory is it has really the youngest population of Australia. I mean, I think the average age of people there is, I think the medium age is 31. So if you think about that, they're more flexible to change and to actually see where opportunities lie. And that's what I find in Darwin. Of course, there are going to be people who say, this is not the old Darwin we used to know. But I've got to say that the young are really embracing, how do we make the most of this? What do we do without selling out and still withholding their own sort of cultural feeling about the place? I think you find that what's happening now is they're starting to listen and be more attuned with, what can we do to maximise this opportunity? And that's what tourism is about. You're hot today, let's make the best of it.
That was Monocle's foreign editor speaking with Robin Holt, former managing director of Monocle magazine. You're listening to Midori House. Stay with us.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about making things better. Each week, I'll take you on a rollicking romp through the worlds of design, craft, architecture, fashion, and graphics, with factory frolics, building tours, product tests, and studio guests.
They're beautiful, they're functional. When you use them, they are completely poetic. They lift that activity, whatever it is, to another level. It makes you aware of the quality of what you're doing.
Tune in every week to hear the stories behind the things that we live with. That's Section D, premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, here on Monocle 24.
With a team of 25 dedicated correspondents and bureaus in Zurich, Tokyo, Hong Kong and New York, Monocle 24 keeps you fully informed on events around the world, around the clock.
For Monocle in Caracas, I'm Sarah Granger.
For Monocle in Abu Dhabi, I'm Christopher Lord.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Aisha Spears.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv.
In Sao Paulo.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Manama. In Paris.
In Ramallah.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
Bangkok.
Los Angeles.
In London.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
In Toronto.
In Laetitia.
Keeping an eye and an ear on the world. This is Monocle 24.
And it is 45 minutes past the hour. And I can report that there are, apparently, seismic changes in the tea industry. Recently, Kenya overtook China in tea exports. Green teas are on the rise. Some of the old established brands on the wane. All of this has got Monocle 24 wondering about the beautiful teas of China and where the future might be. Now, Postcard Teas is a lovely London tea shop and tea school, I might add. And we have the owner of Postcard Teas, Timothy Doffey, right here with us in the studio.
And hello there.
Hello, welcome. And it's sort of tea time, London time, 6:45, a bit late. But nonetheless, I'm looking forward to tasting some tea because I think you've brought some with you.
We've brought a very special tea, which we love.
Okay. Do you want me to tell you more about it?
Yeah, well, let's wait till it comes through the door. And maybe just to get us going a little bit, Chinese newspaper today was full of a big report on how Kenya is like the big tea exporter. It's overtaken China and so on. What's that all about?
Well, the tea...
And the tea has arrived.
Fantastic.
Beautiful. Tea we're gonna... Thank you, Fernando.
Thank you. The tea we're going to drink today is very different from the tea which is being produced in Kenya and... It's being exported from China or Kenya, which is mainly black tea. This is an oolong tea.
Oolong.
Which is in between a green tea and a black tea. It's called semi-oxidized or semi-fermented. And this one's special because it comes from four particular trees in a UNESCO World Heritage Site in a place called Wuyi. And it's made by the maker of the most legendary Chinese tea, which is the six-tree mother tree, Dahongpao, which has been the preserve of emperors for 350 years and was made up until 2005. And the last time it was made, about 2 kilos were made, and it was made by the same man that made this tea. And it sold in auction in 2006 for over $20,000 for 20 grams.
More valuable than gold, perhaps?
I don't know about the prices of gold, but it's that more or less the highest price.
And that's what we're drinking now. So this is sort of like 1,000 pounds a sip?
Or? This is not what you're drinking now. This is drinking by the same, handmade by the same tea maker, and it comes from about a kilometre away from those six original trees. But these trees are between 100 and 120 years old.
I'm drinking it now. I never know how drinking and eating works on the radio, but tea, it's not, we're not being too greedy. It's beautiful. It's a honey-colored tea and...
Should be quite light, sweet, slightly floral, but it's roasted. It's charcoal roasted, which gives it that warmth.
It's delicious.
Oh, good.
Here's what's astonishing. I'm not a tea drinker. I am Canadian, and I think that I don't have the gene for it, but I've been here for many, many years, and I do drink the odd cup.
Mm-hmm.
This is not what they call builder's tea.
It's not. A smell of it, too, because that's a big part of Chinese tea is the aroma.
Gorgeous.
Well, one of the reasons why we chose this tea to bring along was... One, to talk about how special tea can be in China and what tiny quantities. We buy half the 7 kilo production from these four trees every year.
Four trees.
On the packet, here you go. You can see a picture taken by my Chinese colleague Lu of the four trees, all between 100 and 120 years old.
Pretty, little, slightly spindly, almost like a hawthorn tree or something
in
shape.
They're about 12 feet tall, but they're deliberately kept quite low so you can pick them. But sometimes as they get taller, people have to resort to step ladders and things. But why also we bought this tea is that from Wuyi, the British took, some say stole, lots of saplings, tea saplings and also seeds, and took them to India, and they started the black tea production in Darjeeling, and then they found there was a native species in India, and that's the black tea which even the Chinese really call English tea, because the Chinese never really drank black tea. They drank oolong tea and green tea and jasmine tea, but they never really developed this huge passion for black tea that the English did, first of all with Chinese tea and then with Indian, Sri Lankan and Kenyan tea, which was a colonial product of the early 20th century. They started more mechanicalized making of tea. And 60% of the world tea market is black tea.
And it doesn't taste like this.
And it's made for $2-3 a kilo. And that's the market which Kenya has overtaken China in. And it's very good. It's very good tea. Kenyan tea can be delicious. It's wonderful. It's probably what you find in a lot of the supermarket tea bags. And there's nothing wrong with that.
But it's not special. What's the rub then? There's nothing wrong with it.
It's produced, most of it's produced a way which is called CTC, crush, tear and curl. It's like macerated. It's a very quick way of making tea, and it's a quick brewing tea. It works well in a tea bag, or if you want to make a very strong cup of tea, you might brew it loose. That's what Indians mainly drink in India.
Okay. And this is in your lovely silver bag.
It's in a lovely silver bag, but it's, you look at the length of the leaf, and it's pretty different. But for me, the big difference is the kind of black tea we're talking about from Kenya could be made almost anywhere in the world. It's very
dark, greenish.
Greenish green when black. It opens.
Like dried sage or something, all curled up.
Absolutely.
Right?
It gives oolong tea its name. It looks a little bit like a black dragon. So that's why oolong tea is...
very curvaceous.
Yes, and slightly serpent-like.
And oolong is dragon.
Black dragon is the literal translation.
Well, this one, I've got dragon right there.
You've got the dragon in there.
Yes, serpent or something, yes.
But
it's been handled... lightly,
this is completely
delicately.
Handmade.
It's not crushed.
Completely handmade. To make this tea from picking to all processing and all the roasting probably took around about 72 hours over quite a long period. It will be farred a lot of times. We sell this tea for £18.45 for 20 grams.
£18 for 20 grams.
And
how many cups of tea?
20 grams, maybe five, maybe about 20 good cups of tea, or maybe a little bit more.
Yeah.
Depends on how many times you're steeping it.
So, but this is, it's so, there's so many, I want to tell people more about the flavor. It is both refreshing and somehow drying in your mouth. Well, how does that happen? Why does tea do that? Or this particular tea?
Well, for me, a good tea has balance. It has sweetness, but it also has astringency, which is the refreshing side of it. And then a nice tea like this, I hope, has a wonderful aroma. I mentioned that's a big point of Chinese tea. Mm-hmm. With black teas, most black teas don't have that kind of aroma. And the other big difference is this is made once a year. It's picked at one time of year and only that time. Black tea bushes, like the ones in Kenya, are picked through a much longer season. They'll be picked... really,
months.
All through the year,
really?
Apart from in winter when the tea plant will shut down. So it's very difficult. There's a commodity tea, and I would call this a cultural tea.
Wow, it's amazing. You know, and after dinner when people offer you a tea, and I just, it's so, this would be perfect, wouldn't it?
Yes, well, it's supposed to be digestive.
One of the many times in the day, it would be quite appealing, I think, as opposed to some of those sort of sickly herbal things in pouches.
Thank you. Well, we don't sell any tea bags, postcard teas. Doesn't mean that we think there isn't a time and a place and convenience that some tea bags offer, but it's a different thing. We're not tea snobs, though, and I think that's a really important point. So I think you can... Oh, thank you. I think you can... some of the specialty tea industry is very dismissive of... inexpensive black tea produced in East Africa, somewhere like Kenya, Tanzania, now a lot in South America. Lots of blends have large amounts of South American tea in it. And there's nothing wrong with that tea, but it's very different from the very best teas made in China. However, to meet the global demand for new green teas that you were talking about too, that there are a lot of large-scale green teas being produced in China. Not everything is produced this way. So I think the main thing that people should be asking themselves when they're buying a tea and whether they're getting good value for money is, where does it come from? Who made it?
Known provenance.
Absolutely. When was it made?
So, just the way you would with a bottle of wine or oil, olive oil, or
absolutely
any of the fine things we like to buy.
Absolutely.
Put in our... bodies.
Exactly. So if lots of people are making the analogy with fine tea and fine wine, but unless it has that provenance, you can't say that it is a fine tea, in my opinion. You're not learning from it. So that's the big difference, I think.
In a business sense, where's China going with this? You know, we had this lead, Kenya is taking over, but it's a two different types of markets.
Absolutely. It's completely domestic. The Chinese market... we're one of the few people that exports this kind of tea or imports it. Most of it is consumed domestically, and the Chinese demand for ever-increasing specialty teas is growing within China. So it's domestic. They have the money for it.
Wow.
So, I mean, the prices are unreal, some of the things we work with. Lots of the tea makers we work with have sold one of the great green tea maker we work with. 100 grams of his best tea sold for £10,000. So that's £100,000 a kilo if it was prorated up. And a kilo is something pretty small. It's like, you know, those tea bags, those larger bags which have tea bags in them is usually 250 grams. So it's like that.
And it's going for how much again?
£100,000.
So, okay, you're not a tea snob. I can see that you with your lovely jaunty cap and your approach with me. But somebody out there is very serious connoisseur to be able to pay. Who's buying that?
It's cultural because just like... somebody in the West and increasingly now in the East will pay a lot of money for a particular Burgundy or a Bordeaux, right, because they know the cultural significance of that, the fact that it's graced certain tables over the years. In the best Chinese tea, you can pinpoint it to particular trees or particular makers. Therefore, with that kind of provenance, people will pay the right money for a kind of sharing that culture.
But that's such a lot of, I mean, is it in the oligarch's tea caddy at the breakfast table, perhaps? Or, you know,
yeah, sure. I mean,
leader of North Korea, who was very fond of special wine.
Well, the tea that Master Xu made for the original Mother Tree Dahong Pao was offered to Richard Nixon when he first went to, in 72, when he visited China. It was the tea given to him by Mao. So it ends up in political hands and in the wealthy if it is sold.
The time has come to wrap this up, but I think just in 20 seconds, top tip, I wanted to become a tea connoisseur. Now I know I want this tea in my cup, but it's expensive. Look at where it was made, how it was made, who made it.
Absolutely.
And for taste?
Find out what you like and then go for it. Not all tea is expensive. Just like with wine or anything, there are lots of bargains to be had. You know, if this tea comes from another area and is not made by such a famous maker, it may taste fabulous, but it's going to cost a minute amount of the same cost. So it's to do with looking and finding what you like.
What a pleasure to meet you, and thank you very much for coming in and telling us these stories. Timothy Dauphé of Postcard Teas in London, where you can buy tea, taste tea, and even study tea. Thank you very much for being with us.